National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues that affect American national security. National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, which is meeting this year from October 24th to the 26th at the DoubleTree Hotel in Bloomington, Minnesota. And now your host, John Olson.
I'm your host, John Olson. I'm really glad you joined us today. Every Wednesday at 9 a.m., we get together to discuss national security. We're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore challenges in national security. I do want to thank our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. You can find out more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. We're going to jump into our topic for today. On February 1st of 2021, the Burmese military staged a military coup, toppling the democratically elected government of the nation of Myanmar. Nobel laureate and Myanmar state counselor Daw Aung San Suu Kyi and President U Win Myint were arrested, along with numerous members of the cabinet and members of parliament. The military junta has carried out much more violent repression against the various ethnic groups in the nation and has jailed, tried, and convicted numerous democracy activists and former office holders under the previous civilian government. It has been launching Syrian-style air bombing and burning down villages, especially in the northwest part of Myanmar and other ethnic areas. Both the People's Republic of China and Russia have provided significant aid to the military junta, and that presents some difficult national security conundrums for the United States, for our allies and our friends in the region, and also for ASEAN. Joining us today to provide an update on the situation in Myanmar is Professor Tun Myint. Professor Myint was on the air with us back in April of 2021 to provide background on Myanmar and to discuss the first few months under the new military junta's rule. I recommend you look at the archive of our shows and that you listen to that previous show. Professor Myint provided a wealth of knowledge to help you to better understand the complex political, economic, social, and security environment that has been created for Myanmar over a number of decades. Tun is a professor of political science at Carleton College, and he currently chairs the department. In the 1988 democracy movement in Myanmar, Tun Myint served as a student leader, and he remains a widely respected expert on the politics and society of the country, as well as a key advisor to the democracy movement inside Myanmar. Professor Myint is a founder and member of the editorial board of the Independent Journal of Burmese Scholarship, director of the Public Memory of Myanmar Digital Archive, and has contributed expert analysis on Burmese politics for many media outlets. Tun Myint is co-founder of Mutual Aid Myanmar, a nonprofit organization that supports the civil disobedience movement led by doctors and nurses in the early days of the coup, and growing as a national movement in which civil servants are walking out of the office against the military council. Mutual Aid Myanmar has raised over $1 million from individual global donors who care about the fate of democracies against autocracies. Professor Tun Myint, welcome back to National Security This Week.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tun, maybe we should start with just sort of an update for our listeners. You were here, you know, back in April of last year. We had an initial discussion about this. What's the current situation in Myanmar?
The current situation is twofold. One is geopolitical, international, and the second is domestic situation. So in domestic political condition now, the People's Defense Forces, which basically were graduated from protests on the street in the early days of the coup, now they are holding arms and fighting against Myanmar military, and especially northwest region of the country that you mentioned, in where the Myanmar military is responding with Syrian-style bombing and burning down the villages and so on. So that's domestic situation. And that situation is quite unique in the sense the people of the country, 50 million, 55 million people of the country are fighting against its own military that is holding this sovereign sort of position, yet is violating the responsibility of sovereignty itself. Okay. And so in that situation, the protest, CDM movement, the protest, and also the ethnic revolutionary organization and this People Defense Forces, which are mainly led by Generation Z and ethnic armed armies in Myanmar, which has been fighting for over 73 years. So this 19 months now into 20 months of resilience revolution is making sure the military coup leaders could not finish and complete the coup. And so they could not even function like a typical coup government, let alone civilian-like type peaceful government in Myanmar. So that's a domestic situation. Second is that Russia and China, as you put it, is now pouring all out their resources behind. Russia has geopolitical reason. China has economic investment and security of their business reason. So those are the two where it stands now. We can unpack further if you'd like to.
I would actually like to follow up a little bit on that. So you mentioned sort of the Burmese military, the military junta is really using sort of these Syrian style tactics. Are they being advised, do we think, by the Russians on those kinds of tactics?
I think it's not only advised, but also some of the Russian Air Force pilots.
Oh, really?
Were commanding Burmese planes when they were bombing the ethnic Karen area. And about 3 months ago, Thai media reported they spotted through the radar in a Thai military site monitoring the airplanes.
Yeah.
They found Russian pilots who was co-piloting with Burmese or just individually. So Russia is not only training Myanmar Air Force, not only supplying secondhand Myanmar Air Force equipment, but also physically intervening into the situation in Myanmar, which is really important in terms of how Russia is balancing its ads in global geopolitical games of steering conflict around the world, supporting it, and then making enemy pay the cost of, making its rivals, like especially United States and other open democracy, pay the cost of it, basically imposing cost on democracy with their own political ambition and autocracy here.
And then you mentioned that, the fighting that's going on in different parts of the country, as I understand it, and we've had conversations about this in the past, the different ethnic groups may not have been united, but now they really are united, and they're really fighting together against the military junta. Is that right?
Yes. And the entire country, the population, and including ethnic revolutionary organizations, are quite united under the theme of getting rid of Bongyanthu, which is mean common enemy, and Bongyanthu is in Burmese. And common enemy now is a military dictatorship.
Okay.
However, there's China is playing quite an interesting game here. There's an ethnic group in the northeast northern side of Xi'an State, which is northeast of Burma, Wa ethnic group. This Wa ethnic group share population, half of them in China and half of them live in Myanmar. This is border ethnic group. And this group is demanding that they should have a state, like their own autonomous state inside Myanmar, which will be historically very unusual. And China is supporting the demand. And that's one. Second is southwest corner of Myanmar, which is where Rakhine state, where the Rohingya crisis happened in northern Rakhine. Mm-hmm. And Rakhine state, the Arakan army, AA, is also working closely with China in terms of getting their supplies from China and others. So I think this southwest corner of Myanmar and northeast corner of Myanmar, if you draw the line where China is going, it's the Indian Ocean.
Right.
And so this game that China is imposing on Myanmar's ethnic conflict is a newer game in a relatively politically fragile society, which is fragile in the sense of deep into, because of 73 years of civil war in Myanmar is the longest civil war in the world. So China is playing a very interesting political and economic game as opposed to Russia, which is playing geopolitical game against the West here.
More short-term approach on the Russians than the long-term approach by the Chinese.
Is correct, okay. If you take it that way, yes.
Let's drill down into that a little bit more in a little bit. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Tuen Minh, and we're discussing the current situation in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Our show is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, which meets this year from October 24th to the 26th in Bloomington, Minnesota. Tuen, let's talk specifically about the military junta. How much control, actual control, do they have over the nation right now. Are they succeeding in recruiting or conscripting more soldiers to maintain military control over the nation? I have to think there's a lot of resistance to the military's conscription efforts. Can you talk a little bit about that? How do they stay in power? I mean, how do they continue to get manpower to carry out these military operations?
Yes, that's a great question. In July, I had a workshop in Thai-Burma border area with the defected soldiers from Myanmar military. They defected after the coup. And according to their internal inside operation, I'll start with recruitment.
Okay.
Recruitment is almost like zero now, and they are bribing people to pay to be unofficially recruiting. And so if you can recruit five soldiers for a training, you get 75,000 worth of Myanmar jat for one soldier you recruit, and so you can calculate. So these kind of recruitment were reported in that workshop by some of the people who were working in those recruitment division.
Okay.
And then the recent enrollment to the military cadet schools was zero last 2 years now, in 20 months, we have learned. And so recruitment is really down. Defection is increasing. About 10,000 soldiers have defected to the revolution. And so that's one. And then the other area the Myanmar military is trying to stay in power is the cronies and the paid, if you will, thugs, or what in Myanmar called Busoti. It's a group that's not the military, but paramilitary created by the army.
Okay.
And they will be in civilian uniform. And they were also the one who were reportedly responsible for beating up a series of lines of cars led by Aung San Suu Kyi in 2003. She was there almost assassinated in the town of Dipayen. So this group is now re-mobilized by the Myanmar military and military intelligence, which are connected to the Union Solidarity Development Party, USDP, which is also former military men running the political party. So they are now trying to sort of stir things up by creating robberies, thieves, and very unstable situation for population that is, you know, peacefully living in their homes and things like that. So that mobilized, that's a payment. Basically, they get paid for doing what they are doing by the military. So cronies, which are supporting the military to get gold mines and permits in the forest and then other natural resources, including rare earth material mining in Kachin State in northern Myanmar.
Okay.
They were all kind of basically facilitating that kind of staying in power for Myanmar military. So the cronies who are in the almost like what you may call it dark economy, who operate within that, are also behind this Myanmar military. So in terms of financing, I think China and Singapore play a critical role here, and Hong Kong maybe the other area, and the other is Belarus and Russian Eastern Economic Cooperation, which is five countries, Russia-led. So these are very global structure to the local structure that you have in terms of financing. This is how military is surviving at the moment, with the support from Russia, with the support from China.
And I do want to follow up more on that, the regional challenges around Myanmar, but just to see if I can summarize what you just said, there's actually a paramilitary structure that has been reformed that's supported by the military junta, that's almost guided not necessarily directly by the junta, but in some ways, yes, by the junta. But it's also, you have a lot of financial support for the military junta from the people who are getting rich very quickly because they're patrons to the military junta, so they get all the financial benefits, the mines, the logging, all those kinds of things. Is that a good summary?
That is a very good summary. Just there's a one more post, yeah, to pivot to put it is that nationalist Buddhist monks.
Ah.
So these monks are also a part of this this Busoti spiritual side of their structure, if you will.
So they're getting a lot of support.
They're getting a lot of support. And they are also the one that are at the forefront of anti-Rohingya campaign in Myanmar, because Rohingyas are Islamic community members. And so the extremist Buddhist monks and community or Sangha also support military's attempt to
clean it up, which is quote-unquote the term they use, clean up campaign against Rohingya. That's why you saw in 2017, yeah. within a week, nearly 1 million people had to flee. So that is another spiritual point. So you got the money, you got spiritual foundation, and you have here the paramilitary group, which is revitalized since that 2012 era. That group existed. Now, Pusorti is the one that I'm referring to. That's military-led civilian arms. It's not formal, not official, yeah. but they do think that whatever military need to stay in power
like
to support
a,
it.
Like a militia, as we would
militia
understand.
Militia, yeah.
Paramilitary right. militia.
It's hard to really define right. this group.
Fair enough. I have to admit that I'm a little confused because I understood that Buddhist monks were very peaceful at heart. That is traditionally the way it's been interpreted. But from what I'm hearing from you, it's very, very different amongst this nationalist group of Buddhist monks in Myanmar.
Yes. In theory and philosophy and teaching of Buddhism, it's a very peaceful. However, the authoritarian in anywhere or dictators in anywhere would utilize religion yeah. to basically structure their own spiritual foundation of their power. So in several reports indicate that some of the monks are basically military intelligence who are just wearing the orange robes and pretending to be basically, to use crudely, to be a monk in Myanmar. And they are basically working for the military MIS, military intelligence services, and other political and economic interests. And so not all monks in Myanmar sure. are really monks, even though they might be wearing orange robe and pretending to be or a monk. So within the Sangha in Myanmar, there is a significant split between staying with the original teaching of Buddha, being peaceful, kind, harmonious society, promoting ecology and society type, and then the other who are basically politically exploited. So when you are exploited monks from Myanmar military and cronies, you have bigger temples and you have a flat panel TVs and Mercedes Benz for you and the best cars and everything. The people, quote-unquote, donate them. That donation come with the price for those monks to work for the sake of military dictatorship continuing to function in Myanmar. So it's really anthropologically speaking, this is a very interesting arena or field to study. There are a lot of study how religion has been used in political establishment, but this is a kind of unique in the sense, in modern sense of usage of religion in Myanmar.
I got to tell you, Tim, I spent 25 years dealing with national security issues while I was in the Navy. I've been teaching it for a decade. I have never heard a situation as complex as the one that you just laid out for us. I mean, it is a really turns everything on its head about how you understand things function typically in any country around the world.
Now you can appreciate 73 years of civil war in Myanmar, right? Yeah. The longest one in the world.
Oof. So there is, as you mentioned, a well-organized unity government that's working feverishly to defeat the military junta and to restore the foundations of democratic governance back to Myanmar. Can you tell our listeners more about that democracy movement inside and even outside Myanmar? How are they organized? Who are the members? What is it that they seek to achieve maybe in the near term and over the long term, specifically with their resistance to the junta?
Yeah. It's a multifaceted dynamic revolution in Myanmar, sustained by Strike Committee Myanmar inside Myanmar, where they continue to organize protests, even if it's small, villages and towns, including capital Yangon.
And Strike Committee. These are peaceful protests.
These are peaceful protests. Yeah. And second is a CDM, Civil Disobedience Movement, that you mentioned earlier. So Civil Disobedience Movement are people, participants are government workers who are working out of their offices. And so Mutual Aid Myanmar, that I co-founded, fund them for their food, shelter, medicine, and so on. And that's a second. The third is Ethnic Arms Organization, or now Ethnic Revolutionary Organization. They are also sustaining their own locality, plus training some of the People Defense Forces, which is coordinating with Ethnic Arm Organization and People Defense Forces. People Defense Forces are mainly former peaceful protesters decided to take arms up against this military council. So that's the third people of it. And the fourth one is national unity government, which is composed of members of parliament elected on November 8, 2020 election. And so that was nullified by the coup on February 1st, 2021, and which was the day that national parliament was going to hold at 9 a.m., at 3 a.m. military stage, a peaceful coup when members of parliament were sleeping in their dormitory in the capital, Naypyidaw. So this government, national unity government, is favorably viewed by a lot of global governments, especially democracies, and some of the countries in Southeast Asia and Asian countries as well, meaning that they are tactically working together day-to-day, sort of practically, but officially they haven't made a statement or a declaration that they recognize national unity government as the official government of the people of Myanmar, which is the true statement because they were elected people, right?
Yeah.
And this government is the most diverse political body that had emerged in the history of Myanmar. I mean, diverse means ethnic people and also younger generation and plus female politicians are actively engaging in this political process. So United States is recognizing, at least at the practical level, talking with them, sharing information, helping them out and all that. So hopefully democracies, including the United States, will recognize this national unity government as the government of Myanmar and the people of Myanmar, and United Nations at the same time recognize permanent ambassador of UN Myanmar ambassador to United Nations, permanent ambassador to United Nations, who was Aung San Suu Kyi's representative to the UN. Now United Nations continue to recognize him as a ambassador of Myanmar, not the ambassador of the military hunter structure. So that's another complex layer here, which is in the IR field.
So is that national unity government, the people who were in fact democratically elected to various roles in the government and parliament, are they like in exile? Have they fled the country so that they can continue to operate?
They are. Some of them are in liberated areas within Myanmar or Burma. Mainly in Kachin, Shan, and also the Karen. Mainly in Kachin and Karen, I think, and also northwestern part of Myanmar, and then some of them are in Europe, some of them are in United States, some of them are in Thailand, and then maybe in Singapore. I don't know. I mean, they are all spread out, and this is basically national unity government of Myanmar globally located, of everywhere, and which is also one reason why the Burmese diaspora and all over the world are actively engaging in funding and fundraising activities and things like that. So this is a revolution that is defending democracy and also defending sovereignty, a true sovereignty of we the people in the world, right? Yeah. And so unique in a sense, this is the largest revolution in the history of all the revolution in terms of defending democracy in a country. Yeah. So if democracies around the world actually mean that they are democratic and they want to protect democracy, Burma case is much more important case and significant case than supporting Ukraine, for instance, right? And so this media, global media, tend to look over this. It is in my analysis of the future of democracy and the future of sovereignty, Myanmar or Burma case right now is far more critical and important than the crisis in Ukraine.
Yeah. Before we take a short break here, this unity government that's sort of in exile spread around the world, they couldn't function as effectively as they have been without the power of technology, right?
True. Technology, Zoom parliament, you might call it, and Signal parliament or Signal meetings, meeting room through the app Signal. Yeah. So, yes, technology, social media is critical for the national unity government to continue to drum up resources, funding, and also support from global. And they also have their own sort of people who are working on these social media sites, and like health and education ministry, for instance, delivering Zoom classes to students inside Myanmar from their home if they have phone and internet connection and VPN. Wow. They can attend those classes. And so National Unity Government right now, actually, in terms of territorial control, back to the question you asked earlier, reportedly now they're controlling nearly 75% of territory.
Wow.
And now put that in the perspective, Myanmar military members dare not shop in the community street shops with the uniform, right? And they dare not go out and shop or eat or drink tea at the tea shop. And so you can see how the population really do not want to see anymore the military dictatorship. And now even the uniform, they don't want to allow on the street.
That is fascinating. We have to take just a 60-second break.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, which is meeting this year from October 24th through the 26th at the DoubleTree Hotel in Bloomington, Minnesota. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
Professor Tuneman, let's go ahead and move back to the broader regional situation. You mentioned a few of the challenges that are around Myanmar, China and Russia specifically, but what are Myanmar's neighboring governments doing right now to support the military junta? And we'll start with that, and then I'll ask you about what they're doing to support the unity government.
I think to answer that question, we need to look at sort of geopolitical and all the geographical location of Burma, Myanmar. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the location of Myanmar or Burma, Myanmar is sort of sandwiched between three regional powerful groups. One is India on the west, and then north and northeast is China, and then southeast is Southeast Asian countries, association, ASEAN, right? So within that triangle, Burma critically is situated. It's critically in, means in a geopolitical and also economic and also politic, ethnic politic level.
Okay.
And because Burma is the second most diverse country after Indonesia in terms of ethnicity and ethnic politics. So if you view that, and India is sort of also led by the Hindu nationalist party, and therefore they are quite sympathetic with nationalist theme of Myanmar military.
Ah.
And therefore they are not outright supporting democracy movement, but they are kind of under the table. They have been at the second and third level leaders of Indian governments have been working with Myanmar military. And in fact, they are also facilitating some kind of armed trade and also financial flow, I think, through Central Asia and Russia. Because Russia and Russian leader and Indian leaders are also somewhat quite, you know, in a good term, I would say, if not too close. That's point number one. Point number two, China, as I said, two ethnic groups, Arakan and Wa, trying to connect the dot. Right now, they have physically already connected because there's gas pipeline from Arakan state to Yunnan province. It's already functioning, flowing the gas, right? So, but they need to do political and some other detailed, sensitive, local, ground, transnational work, if you will. And that is what China is interested in. It's investment mainly. There are about 519 investment projects led by China, which is the largest foreign...
Just in Myanmar.
Just in Myanmar, 519. The largest investor in Singapore. But Singapore and Chinese sort of business-wide connections, you have to treat it the same. They work out anthropologically. They are the same ethnic groups. And so they do that, right? So that's point number two. Number three is within the ASEAN countries, 10 nations, Indonesia, Malaysia are at the forefront of supporting democracy movement in Myanmar, especially Malaysia. You can connect the dot here, Rohingya crisis in the Western, which are Islamic community. They are very sympathetic with genocide the United States designated, and also Gambia government that brought the case to the International Court of Justice. I mean, that is Malaysia and Indonesia's position. The other country, Philippines, is quite quiet because it's quite It can be because it's quite far away from the mainland, Southeast Asia. But Thailand is an interesting one. Thailand itself is under the military. But Thailand is also used to be under the military for a long time. In fact, the country that in the world that has the most military coup, if you count all the coups.
That's true.
And yeah. So you have Thai people are quite used to living under military or no military. It doesn't matter for them. And so now, currently, Thailand is under the military, and so Thai military and Myanmar military have some good relationship. And at the same time, Thailand also being a friend of democracy, which is a friend of the United States, go back all the way to 1939 and beginning of the monarchy there, and Vietnam War and all that relationship that United States have constructed with Thailand. So that relationship also enable and also sort of unenable Thailand to completely all out go support military. So Thailand is now supporting both Myanmar military and also at the same time democratic revolutionary movement, people who need to stay on Thai Burma border towns and Thailand and things like that. So Thailand in that sense is kind of they have to Thailand has to be carefully structuring their support in both sides in a very sensitive manner because they don't want to stir things up in their own country. So Thailand's but Laos and Cambodia tend to be basically quite quiet in terms of their political power, not saying anything. But Cambodia lately has been becoming more and more anti-military as well, because Cambodia, being a current chair of the ASEAN, tried to do a lot of things and couldn't do, and they learned something hard from with the Myanmar relationship. So it would be interesting where Cambodia would swing if China and United States begin to engage actively in there. Which way would it swing to in terms of Myanmar politics? So this geopolitical situation and also location of the Burma is critical. Here, with the Indo-Pacific equation, security equation for the United States and also for democracy, this is a pretty important, I might say, the most important, even far more important than supporting Taiwan. If you are thinking of China's, if China has direct access to Indian Ocean, west of Malaysia and all of that, Southeast Asia, west of that area, territory control, and then I'm talking about the water.
Right.
Imagine what could U.S. Navy ships and Chinese Navy ships control each other and play the game here. China is very eyeing to that level of control. So with that, it is now constructing political and economic path from the northeast of Myanmar to southwest of Myanmar.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I find it extremely disappointing that, you know, by population, the largest democracy in the world, India, is not supporting the national unity government openly. I understand the nationalism piece to this, but that's very unfortunate. How much pressure is ASEAN able to put on this situation? Are they doing much in the way of, as a grouping of nations, are they working to support the national unity government?
So as a grouping, March of 2021, within a month of military coup in Myanmar, ASEAN put out what they call it five-point plan. And in that plan, they, number one, started with all the violence group have to stop, which at the time, the only group that was inducing violence was Myanmar military, shooting and snipering protester on the street, and the police beating up and arresting and torturing and murdering. ASEAN sort of ignore the fat on the ground in Myanmar. And they could have just pointedly say Myanmar military must stop, right? And instead of saying they're all groups that are engaging in violence. And so point number one. Two was humanitarian aid and other plan, humanitarian aid, sending envoy to Myanmar and negotiating peace and things like that. That five-point plan went nowhere, And so Malaysia is very fed up or not satisfying with that. And so Malaysia is all out calling for recognition of national unity government as the government of the people of Myanmar, which I think the democracies, including the United States, should follow seriously in that lead. Because ASEAN is incapable of functioning as an organization in crisis like Myanmar, for sure. Because it's not well-organized like European Union or NATO.
Right.
So ASEAN is a loose structure, sort of a regional organization. And so for that reason, the Malaysia and Indonesia basically decided, okay, we're going to go alone. And so they're doing coordinated action between Malaysia and Indonesia at this point. Their leadership is critical for so many arena of the world. War and terrorism theme, all of that, if you go back to the post 9/11, and now Islamic countries are supporting democracy, and they themselves are struggling democracy and establishing democracy, right? Rising democracy in Southeast Asia. So if we care about democracy, and people of the world and the countries, democracies around the world, if we care about democracy, this is a huge opportunity. It's an ethically and morally sound political problem here to really to go in and all out support the Myanmar Spring Revolution.
You paint a very complex picture for us, Professor Tunmint. We have about another 10 minutes or so in our discussions today. Let's talk about the role the United States should be playing right now in helping to bring this terrible tragedy to an end. What would you prefer to see the United States doing right now to bring this to an end, or to assist with bringing this to an end?
In the ideal world and in the ideal international relations, theoretical driven world, United States should the Spring Revolution outright. And in fact, also in terms of material support to the People Defense Forces in Myanmar, because they are defending democracy. They are defending the election outcome of November 8, 2020, which is probably more democratic outcome than United States election in 2020. So hypothetically, imagine this. January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol was successful. Imagine that President Biden now, or Biden and Harris now, are in prison in the United States. All the members of Congress are arrested or tortured to death, or some of them fled to Canada and Mexico. And they now run as a national unity government of United States from those countries. And then the towns in the United States, the protests continue soon. Those protesters were arrested, tortured to death. And plus, all the towns like Northfield, Lonsdale, Rochester, all of these towns around the nation in the United States are being bombed. Houses are burned down. What would the United States citizen be doing?
Yeah.
And this hypothetical question is a real question, life, real world, real life, real time, daily question for Myanmar people. And so the citizens of Myanmar basically are defending that democratic election outcome and holding up arms against Myanmar military, which is unjustly using air force to bomb small villages and homes. And
attacking civilians, literally.
Not only civilians, but also attacking schools, bombing schools. That's 3 weeks ago, one school in central Myanmar was bombed. 11 children, ranging from age of 5 to 11, were killed. So imagine that if that were happening in the United States as an outcome, hypothetical outcome of January 6th insurrection. So Myanmar people are facing exactly the practical, not hypothetical situation there. So if you flip that, this is how important, how meaningful a democracy movement in Myanmar is. Yeah. And so United States Congress should do all out if they could make laws and to support the democracy movement, work with the national unity government, recognize it as a democratic government of Myanmar, because it's a democratically elected, more democratic than the 2020 election, Biden's election, right? Though Biden, the one that the Democratic Party won here. So that is my basically the in an idea world. That would be what. But in daily politics, you're dealing with all the elements that we laid out: China's position, and India, and Southeast Asian countries split
and Russia.
Situation. Russia is now geopolitically maneuvering it. Yeah. So you got all kinds of cronies and dark money. We don't know how much Myanmar cronies are connected to Russian oligarchs in terms of financing and offshore financing network that they have, all of that. So these are kind of things that in day-to-day you got to calculate. And you have now Indo-Pacific territorial dispute in South China Sea and then Taiwan issue, right? So in real world, in a non-ideal sort of real-world day-to-day politics, you're dealing with so many issues. But even if you calculate Myanmar's situation within that framework, we have to. I have to say, the democracy movement in Myanmar, both in terms of the future of democracy and the future of the rise of autocracy and populism around the world, Myanmar case deserves far more support than the case in Ukraine. Ukraine case is a kind of, in terms of defending democracy and defending the sovereignty of the people of, we the people of a country, Myanmar case await Ukraine case in terms of deserving.
Yeah, when you paint it in those pictures in that way, I mean, you look at the Ukraine situation. It's really Ukraine and Russia, and then it's, you know, the NATO / EU nations sort of standing against Russia's aggression in Ukraine. When you talk about Myanmar, you have so many other threat vectors basically that you're dealing with regards to who's trying to influence the situation in Myanmar. Are they backing the military junta? Are they backing the National Unity Government? Where you have India, Russia, China, all the ASEAN nations. I mean, there's a lot. It's become sort of a proxy fight for the future of, is it going to be democracy or autocracy? You mentioned that, and honestly, Tuan, that's a tremendous lead-in for the next question I want to ask you before we close out the show today. I know the Department of Political Science at Carleton College is hosting a number of academic panels this year, open to the public, right? Is that right?
Yes, open to the public.
And they're focused on the struggle between authoritarianism and democracy. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about those panels, maybe dates and topics and who the panelists will be?
Yes. So we are in a trimester system. The Department of Political Science designated the entire year to be devoted to autocracy versus democracy theme, basically deconstructing the threat to democracy at home in the United States and around the world, and what is the future of freedom for individuals and communities around the world, mm-hmm. regardless of who you are, what identity you have. So with that, October 27th, Thursday, we will have a panel of four of my colleagues, Barbara Allen, who is a professor of political science, who is expert on United States politics, American politics. She will be digesting the January 6th insurrection and thereafter. And then we have Professor Dev Gupta, who is a national the specialist on social movement and nationalism around the world, and so she'll be speaking how that populist movement, social movement, and the nationalism are playing out with state and sovereignty and things like that. And then we have Professor Krishna Farhat, who is a specialist on misinformation, fake news, and so on, social media, and public opinion, sort of influencing public opinion. She will be also dissecting that through the January 6th and fake news and all of that, and how democracy is being challenged by the rise of social media platforms around the world, not just in the United States. And I will be speaking on the challenge of whether we might be asked now a question out into the post-globalization era, if I can use that, whether democracy or sovereignty will be protected in the future of this world order. Sovereignty, which is the Treaty of Westphalia and Westphalian Order, has been sort of championing a keynote in international relation. Now, would democracy take over? Because around the world, sovereign itself are violating their own responsibilities and abusing human rights and causing genocides and all that around the world, including in China with the Uyghurs problem,
right.
Which would be comparable to Rohingya and Myanmar problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the challenge of global order, whether to protect sovereignty or whether to protect democracy, might be a question that is rising right now as we speak.
Yeah, and I like to remind people when I talk to them about, you know, the situation we face in the world today. Up until the Russian invasion of Ukraine, I think, you know, most of us who study international relations, those of us who serve in the national security arena, we fully recognize that there was a strong competition that had started between the liberal democracies of the world and these rising autocratic nations and their challenge of the global system. And after the Russians invaded Ukraine, it wasn't below the table anymore. It was right there for everybody to see. It was on the table.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So that fight is incredibly important, and it's something that has swallowed up all of the members of your country in Myanmar. They're right in the middle of this struggle.
Yes, and so in the winter term at Carlton, we'll be actually looking at China, Eastern Europe, by four of our colleagues, and then Latin America, and especially how China's relationship to Africa, Latin America, and Europe might shape up this game of democracy versus autocracy or autocracy versus democracy. That's in the winter. In the spring, we have Professor Greg Muffley and you yourself will be running a simulation on war games and other competitive sort of the political games that is unfolding in Asia-Pacific and Indo-Pacific region.
Yeah.
So those three panels that we at the Department of Political Science at Carleton are devoted to democracy versus autocracy theme. And our students are, through the classes and discussions and panels and public event, we are deconstructing this issue.
Tun, if it's okay with you, on future shows, I'd like to just remind our listeners that those panels are available in the winter, in the fall and winter terms, and I'll let them know where they can go if they'd like to go sit in and listen to what the professors have to say.
Yes, it will be in the Department of Political Science. I think we have now facility enough to hold a big public event, classroom, so it will be all there. Winter date and spring date. I think you're doing on May 17, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Winter date has not been designated yet. Four of my colleagues are deciding which date they would probably.
Well, I'll let our listeners know when we've got those dates locked in.
Yes, thank you.
Professor Tunman, thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to shift over and talk to our sponsor for a little bit for the rest of this show. But really, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for sharing the information about Myanmar's crisis with the people in the United States.
Well, maybe we'll have you on again to have another update, depending upon how things are shaking out in the future.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Tun.
Have a nice day.
And Eileen Manning is joining us now. Eileen is a co-founder of the Cybersecurity Summit. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Cybersecurity Summit, Eileen?
Absolutely. This is our 12th year for the Cybersecurity Summit. It's built by cybersecurity professionals for cybersecurity professionals. We have people coming from around the world to attend this. It was an event that was actually built for Minnesota, because Minnesota is so critical to our national infrastructure, with all 16 critical infrastructure headquarters based here, and with so many healthcare and medical device companies and so many Fortune 500 companies, more Fortune 500 companies per capita than anywhere else in the country. So we knew that when the cyber attacks were really going to start happening, that Minnesota was going to be critical to the global security issue. So that's why the summit was built here for Minnesota.
And where is it taking place this year, the dates and location?
It's going to be at the DoubleTree South, which is right on 494 and 100, the old Radisson. It's going to be October 24th, 25th, and 26th. So it's 3 days of programming, over 135 speakers from around the world.
And you cover, is it sort of cybersecurity for government at all levels, from municipalities through counties, states, and federal level? It's the business community, maybe the nonprofit community. Do you talk a little bit about the academic communities as well? They're all included?
Well, so when we started this summit 12 years ago, the Technological Leadership Institute at the University of Minnesota said, it's really, really important that we have both the private and the public sectors coming together to collaborate. So there is stuff for everything. We have a full-day public sector track.
Okay.
So if you're from the city of Golden Valley or Blaine or, you know, wherever you are around the country, and you're challenged by how do I talk to our citizens about, you know, with the fact we need to budget for cybersecurity. How do we make that argument when we need X million dollars a year to plow the streets of snow. I mean,
right.
You know, it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
And so there's that public sector session is for you because it talks about the new CISA grants and what's out there for communities to get in regards to cybersecurity funding. And it's bringing together people from the public sector from around the country for that day. But that's a public sector track. There's also a healthcare and medical device track. You know, we have these amazing leaders in healthcare like Optum and Medtronic. They come together and they co-chair this event, and they pull in people from Boston Scientific and Mayo Clinic and Abbott Labs and all these other amazing organizations to come together and share what their experiences are in regards to protecting the medical devices in the healthcare industry. So you're going to hear from leaders in healthcare and medical device. So if you're a small medical device manufacturer and you need to be thoughtful of what kind of cybersecurity you're putting on, you know, security you're putting on your medical device, this is a great session for you to come to. Or if you're running a hospital and are concerned about ransomware.
You know? Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing as you mentioned, both the medical side and the public sector side is the ransomware. We've seen instances of that all around the country.
Absolutely. And we'll be talking about that. So we have on Monday at the summit, we have a public sector day. We have an industrial controls day. So there's so many devices that are out there that are old legacy devices, and how do we build security into manufacturing, et cetera. So there's Industrial Controls Day. There's also a full day of women in cybersecurity. All building right. diversity in this workforce is really important to us. And I am very proud of the fact that I think we have probably the most diverse in every way, from age to ethnicity to topic subject experts at the summit, with over 135 speakers coming from all over. So we're really big on the diversity issue and helping people advance in their career in cybersecurity, but also for those people that are considering pivoting from maybe technical field into cybersecurity. There's all sorts of sessions for you to come and explore a career in cybersecurity. There's also Monday is a full day of technical tracks where there's a variety of complimentary sessions on all sorts for the practitioner on all sorts of issues around cybersecurity. So we have there's over 50 programs going on just on Monday alone. Something for everybody. But those are mainly for, like you said, public sector communities and the corporate people. And then Tuesday and Wednesday is our full summit. That's when the senior leaders come together and we bring in the experts. We have the deputy director from CISA coming in. We have Beth Sanner, who has been advising the president of the United States for the last 4 years on everything security. And she's going to be talking about how the nation states are weaponizing cybersecurity and what we need to be concerned about there.
And we'll actually be doing a remote broadcast from the Cybersecurity Summit on Wednesday the 26th. And I'll offer national security this week. And my guest will be Beth Sanner, as a matter of fact.
So. Yeah, she'll be in a fascinating interview. Yeah. Her experiences are just amazing. And that's the kind of people that we bring in. We bring in experts from all over that have seen all sorts of things, and they're willing to sit down and share with us so that we go into things with our eyes wide open. And that's the theme of this year's summit is eyes wide open. Right. But also on Tuesday, we offer a small business cybersecurity session.
Right.
And the SBA and the SBDC and CISA and Department of Homeland Security and a variety of others all come together and put on this half day of programming. That is free to virtually attend for small business owners, small and medium business owners. And it's $29 if you want to attend in person. And that includes, you know, being there and the networking reception with solution strategy providers at the end of the day. So we try to provide a lot. There's a lot of scholarships available for students. So we really try to provide a wide range of issues around this ever-increasing topic of concern.
I have to imagine that you've reached out to all the chambers of commerce around the state of Minnesota to let them know about this great opportunity for their small business owners.
You know what? We are still a small marketing team. And so thank you for mentioning that. So if you're a chamber of commerce out there listening, please promote this. It's www.cybersecuritysummit.org. So yeah, we can use all the help we can get in spreading the word about this incredible event that's happening in your backyard.
Yeah, I think you framed it perfectly, the importance of cyber and cybersecurity and understanding this this advancing technology. It changes so fast. If there are academics out there listening to this show who hear this, the state of Minnesota, we're one of the least invested in computer science courses for kids in grade school, junior high, and high school. Is there something that the Cybersecurity Summit is hopefully maybe working on for the future to get that investment into our education system in the state of Minnesota?
You know, I've done a lot of different sessions with the students, and it's fascinating. We did something at the Science Museum a couple of years ago where we brought in students from like 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade to expose them to a career in cybersecurity. And I am blown away at how some of the questions that I've gotten from some of these young minds about cyber. And we have to get them exposed at an early age into cyber as a career. It's a great career to get into. It's a career that's going to be around for a long time, and you're going to have job security, and you graduate, and it's a high paying job as well. So it's a great career to consider.
Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the Cybersecurity Summit?
Well, you mentioned the academics. You know, we do have scholarships available. While Minnesota, you mentioned, hasn't done a lot to we need a lot more programming going on. The state of Minnesota does step up, and they help to underwrite some student scholarships for the summit. So we've got scholarships for all the different universities for students to come and participate, because we want to shape those young minds now and start helping them think about how they need to think as a visionary leader in the future.
And Eileen Manning, one more time, where is the Cybersecurity Summit taking place again this year?
It is taking place at the DoubleTree Hilton on 494 and 100. It's Normandale Boulevard. And there's just one more thing I just remembered to plug in. So if you're anybody working in the field of cybersecurity, on Tuesday evening at the summit, we have the Visionary Leadership Awards dinner. And this is going to be an amazing event this year, because we want to honor everyone working in the field of cybersecurity, not just the honorees that we're going to be recognizing that evening. But in our mind, anyone who is working in cybersecurity is one of our cyber heroes. And so, therefore, I've connected with a legendary rock star. His name is Dominic Allen. He was part of the rock group Foreigner, traveled around the world with Foreigner, and he is coming to the summit on Tuesday evening, October 25th, and he is going to help us rock out.
All right.
he has built out a custom program just for our cyber heroes, and custom songs. Our theme, I said, is Eyes Wide Open. He's got a custom song for that. He's put together an entire program for the evening, and it's going to be it's a wonderful way to network with the cybersecurity community, and it's a wonderful way to have a fun evening.
Yeah, and where, again, the website where people can find all this information?
www.cybersecuritysummit.org, cybersecuritysummit.org.
All right. Eileen Manning, co-founder of the Cybersecurity Summit, I want to thank you personally for stepping in and sponsoring National Security This Week for the next year.
Well, thank you. National Security is of utmost critical importance, so the summit is honored to be a sponsor of this. So thank you, John.
Thank you, Eileen. And then, folks, that does it for today's show. This is National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to our show again next Wednesday morning. Our guest next week, as a matter of fact, will be Mr. John Darby, who recently retired as the Director of Operations for the National Security Agency. You're absolutely going to want to tune into that show. It's going to be fascinating. We will talk about cyber issues next Wednesday, as a matter of fact. If you have ideas for topics you'd like us to cover on this show, please contact KYMN Radio, and I will find experts who can join us to address your topic. Thanks again to our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. You can find out more about the 12th Annual Summit happening this year from October 24th to the 26th in Bloomington, Minnesota. Visit their website at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. Thanks, everybody. Have a great finish to your week. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues that affect American national security. National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, which is meeting this year from October 24th to the 27th at the DoubleTree Hotel in Bloomington.
I feel so tense and worried all the time. Is this anxiety?
Mental Health Minnesota.